Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, and welcome once again to History Dweebs. I am Tim, and the topic of our podcast today is the Moors murders, which occurred in England back in the 1960s, and it's a couple of England's most infamous serial killers, Ian Brady and Myra Henley. So we're going to get into their dastardly deeds. But before we do, let me introduce our panel. I am joined, as always, by the very lovely and talented, the Queen of Mean, the Mistress of the Macabre, the Empress of Evil, Satan's Dirty Little Secret, Brandy.
The Devil.
How are you, Brandy?
I'm okay, Timmy. How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
Yeah, you're having a rough day.
Yeah, or a bad week, but it's okay. So, how are you feeling?
What's giving you a bad week, Timmy?
No, I'm just having mental health issues.
Well, aren't we all? Yes. I'm not allowed to say that.
No.
Are we violating some kind of HIPAA thing by
discussing it? No, I think you're allowed to discuss your own issues.
Oh, okay.
You can't discuss other people's.
Well, okay, I didn't want to tell people about your peculiarities, but
that's okay. And we've discussed this off the air. You're a grown man calling yourself the Hawk and the Colonel in the third person. You're not allowed to point out other people's oddities. Is that fair, Brandy?
I think it's pretty fair.
Well, while that might all well be true, Timmy, that does not make you two any less peculiar.
I'm not peculiar. My shit's straight. I am not peculiar.
She says she's not peculiar?
I'm quirky.
As my friend Bill Shakespeare once pointed out, thou dost protest too much.
No, I'm not protesting at all. I'm saying I'm quirky.
I believe she's protesting, Timmy.
It's a part of her charm. Okay, I'm also joined, as you can tell. He talks before he's allowed to talk.
He does, before people know he exists.
We're going to get him a mic that we can turn on and off. We are joined, as always, by the very talented, the very honorable and distinguished, the most dangerous man in podcasting today, Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as the Southern Gentleman. How are you today, Colonel?
Could not be any better, Timmy. Could not be any better.
Are you excited about this podcast?
I'm excited about this podcast. I want Brittany Nicole, your little team devil varmint you.
She's a very nice lady.
Picture's on the way.
Who affectionately refers to him as the Southern Gentleman? I've always wondered.
That'd be my mom.
Again, it's himself.
Lovingly. He lovingly refers to himself that way.
I'm going to give a quick shout out to Charlie.
Wait a minute, with Brittany Nicole.
Brittany Nicole her picture of me and my faithful sidekick, Rutabaga.
Brittany is so sweet. She had offered to contribute to our Patreon page, but I told her that we decided that we were not going to accept donations right now because
we're all three independently wealthy.
Clearly,
we're not going to charge people for this crap.
I can see us taking $5 and have the FCC come down on us.
So thank you, Brittany. It was very sweet of you for your offer, but we decided at this point we're not going to pursue donations. But unless Bill Gates is out there and wants to give us $1 million or something, then we might reconsider.
Yeah, we might reconsider. Another one, Charlie. Who, I liked your comment,
Charlie's
Charlie.
My favorite person.
Yeah, Charlie.
My favorite
Brandy,
person.
Brandy, the greatest woman ever, and Chuck.
Charlie, and she has her podcast, which is Unblocked.
And I listened
Unblocked.
To one last night.
It's very good. I listened to it as well.
It was this was a bunch of moms sitting around talking about books for kids.
Mm-hmm. But she has different topics.
I only had time to listen to one.
Mm-hmm. Talking about books for kids? kids. Did you get some suggestions for reading materials?
I did, actually.
Well, you should get this, on it. Where the wild things are. Harry Potter is right thing up your and alley. Yeah. Yeah.
But no, it was actually she has a very good voice for podcasting. Her sound's far better than ours.
Yeah, I know. We were talking about microphones, and we got a more expensive microphone, but our sound sucks.
Well, I think we're doing it in this echo chamber in here, but anyway.
The devil's den.
Yeah, the devil's den. That's what it's a devil's cave. It's a devil cave.
Yeah.
And
oh my gosh.
Well, it's, you know what it's like? It's like that trip down to the River Hades, you know?
River Styx.
Or Dante's Inferno.
The River Styx, you dill hole.
No, Hades, River Styx isn't Hades.
Yeah, but it's not the River Hades.
No, down the trip down to the river in Hades.
Yeah, totally not what she said, but that's okay. Styx.
But anyway.
You two seem to be.
Charlie has a very good podcast. It's called
She has a lot and a lovely voice, and I think she'd be a good replacement for the devil.
Well, she would.
That's hurtful. That's so hurtful.
Of course, almost anyone would. So.
Especially when I'm so close to death. That's so hurtful.
Well, that's why we need a replacement. I mean, we got a devil.
The show must go on.
I don't want you to die. I got to say that. I
got
to be.
Although we got some really great ratings when Brandy was out.
We did?
Yeah.
We did any nice comments?
Really?
It seems like that's when we get to 5 stars on iTunes,
yeah,
Tim.
It does. And there's a rash of them. So
that's my shout outs. I do have, now we were lucky enough to get a sponsor.
Oh god.
And for those of you who
I thought we were done with sponsors. Go ahead.
No, now it's February, but you know what's gonna be upon us close enough. Soon enough. It's springtime, Timmy.
Well, yeah.
Springtime. Now what comes with springtime for you homeowners?
Rain.
Landscaping.
Oh, okay.
You gotta get your landscaping done.
Sure.
And as our sponsor today is a landscaping company.
Don't mind me, I'm texting my girlfriend.
And if you need some bushes planted or weeding done or whatever, you can call the Dirty Hoe. And they will come out and do your landscaping.
I'm very familiar with the Dirty Hoe.
Yeah, the Dirty Hoe Landscaping. They are our sponsor for today.
Okay, you got 2 more shout-outs you have to do. You know that, right?
I got my lady Beverly,
who is
just continues to be wonderful, and I have who?
My mom.
That's right. Do I even need to say a name? D. Can somebody give me a D? Give me a D.
Let's don't do that.
Come on, give me a D. I'm not going to you. Give me a D.
D.
O.
Brandy.
Somebody give me a no.
No, I don't. I don't want to play these. I don't want to play this.
I will. You know what, I can do this all day.
I know.
Give me a no.
Come on, let's get to the podcast.
Dottie Scott.
I want to talk about these murders.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dottie, we hope you're on the mend. We hope you're doing well. We hope Timmy don't try to kill you again.
She's doing fine. She's doing better. I also want to shout out to Stevers, who sent us a very nice email on the Bricka murders. He had some pretty interesting insights to that, which now requires me to put him on a list of probable suspects. No, just kidding.
he had some insider information on that.
Yeah, but no, he did ask some pretty good questions that I never thought about, so... He's we have to do one of these again. We'll have to get him involved because he had some pretty good thoughts on that whole murder case. So we hope you enjoyed that. We don't usually do unsolved murders, so because we like making fun of the perpetrators, right?
And always
you do unsolved murders, all you have are victims. So
it's hard to make fun of the victims.
Yeah, it's not as good. But also shout out to Celine and Mary Ray and Stephanie Q.
Kim Taylor,
to Scott, all of our regular listeners, thank you for listening, and we appreciate it. But now let's get on to the Moore's murders, and I bet Lady Beverly is very familiar with this.
Lady Beverly is probably an expert on this.
Probably so. So if we screw up some of the pronunciations, remember we don't do well with American pronunciation, so
yeah.
When it comes to another country, we really suck. So
speak for yourself.
People in Britain talk funny.
No, they talk the Lord's English.
Did you hear somebody said we had accents?
Yeah, Cincinnati accents. Yeah,
what
is
that?
The King's English.
I didn't know we had. I didn't know there was such
kind
a thing.
Of a
aside
of,
from
it's a hybrid.
Colonel Sanders over here. I didn't know that we had. Foghorn Leghorn. Besides that, I didn't know that we had.
Cincinnati is a hybrid. It's a distinct.
Come on, Cliff Clavin.
It's a hybrid. Tell me. Southern Midwestern accent. Cincinnati is called the Queen City, the gateway to the South. And
I don't care about any of this.
So it's a hybrid.
Timmy.
Worth murders.
Timmy has got the Chillicothe accent.
That would be Portsmouth.
Whatever. One of those eastern Appalachian towns.
Yeah, we are not associated with Chillicothe.
Oh, though. He took offense to that.
Yes. Portsmouth people are too good to be
Chillicothe. What does that say?
Their town stinks. I love you, Chillicothe. All of our listeners in Chillicothe, I love you, but that paper, a meat paper company.
Ain't nobody in Chillicothe got the internet. There ain't no listeners of that.
I think we have a few. Anyway, the Moore's murders. Okay, let's talk about that. Okay. Shall we?
Let's.
Okay.
If you get started.
It's a story of Ian Brady and Myra Henley, a couple of ne'er-do-wells who hook up, become boyfriend and girlfriend, and go around killing kids. Not a very cool thing to do.
Really depends on the kid.
Well, not these kids. These kids are pretty innocent. The Moore murders were carried out by Ian Brady and Myra Henley between July of 1963 and October of 1965 in around what is Greater Manchester, England, which is where Manchester is where?
Manchester is where Eric Clapton is from.
No, it's where, I don't know about that, but it's Manchester United.
Manchester, soccer, that's where
football team.
The football, what they call football.
We call it soccer.
Real football, yeah.
Yeah. The victims were five children between the ages of 10 and 17. The victims' names were Pauline Reed, John Kilbride, Keith Bennett, whose body has never been found, Leslie Ann Downey, and Edward Evans, at least four of whom were sexually assaulted. Again, Keith Bennett's body has never been found, so we're not sure about them. The murders are so named, Moore murders, because the first two victims were discovered in graves dug on the Saddleworth Moors outside of Manchester. And it's a desolate kind of, I don't know if you went on the internet and looked at the pictures of the place. It's kind of desolate. It's cool looking. I would love to visit there, but it is also kind of creepy looking. It's just kind of out of the city. And anyway, it's like desert. It's just
the only thing I know about this thing is the 10 pages of stuff you just handed me when I walked in the door.
Thank you, Colonel. The third grave was discovered in that area in 1987, 20 years after Henley and Brady were convicted of the murders. So, and as I said, the body of the fourth victim, Keith Bennett, he's also suspected of being buried there, but despite repeated searches, his body has never been recovered. So let me tell you a little bit about Ian Brady. Ian Brady was born in Glasgow, Scotland, to Margaret Peggy Stewart, and grew up in a tough slum neighborhood of Gorbals. And again, forgive me if I'm not pronouncing this right. Peggy was a single mom, which meant Ian was a
bastard.
God.
And I'm guessing, I haven't seen this script, but I'm guessing along the line he got a stepfather to beat the hell out of him.
Maybe. Peggy was a tea room waitress. And I know you've waited and been a waitress in a tea room before.
I have been a waitress in a
tea room. He was working as a waitress in a tea room bar when we met him.
When you first met me.
Yes. Yeah.
But even knew I'd have a much better life.
Yeah,
either with or without us.
Without you,
yes.
Yeah. Anyway, Peggy Stewart worked as a tea room waitress and found it difficult bringing up a child on her own, and she really hoped to spare her son Ian the stigma of
being a bastard,
being illegitimate. This was, again, early '60s, so that there was a social stigma attached to being.
When I go to the flea market and I see Coach purses,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure
you better grab them.
They're illegitimate to me.
Yeah,
they're not illegitimate.
But when I see kids, even though one's a little bastard, Yeah. He's still a legitimate kid.
Yeah, I know. I don't like the
term. I mean, that's a legit
kid. Right there.
It's a legit kid.
I don't like the term either, but it's just...
I like the term bastard. There ain't nothing wrong with that, but illegitimate just don't make no sense.
But on your own children.
Yeah.
I don't like either term. But anyway, so she gave young Ian up to a family, the Sloan family, who lived nearby, and they kind of took him in and adopted him as their own. Ian's father has never been identified, his real father. Peggy Stewart, his mom, claimed that his father was a journalist who died a few months before he was born. Early on, Ian showed some troubling signs of dysfunctional behavior and moodiness. When he could not have his way, he would throw violent tantrums, which sometimes ended him with him banging his head against the wall.
Sounds like the devil.
Yeah, sounds like her on a good day.
Yeah, on a good day.
His mom, occasionally, Peggy occasionally would come visit her son and indulge him with gifts. And Ian soon kind of figured it out, put two and two together and realized that Peggy was really his mother, and that made him act out even more. And it kind of become known around the neighborhood that that was the case, and he was kind of ostracized because of it. And the more he was ostracized, the more unsociable he became. He kept to himself. He seemed to resent the fact that he was born out of wedlock, and he began kind of being a rebel, and he wasn't. He didn't feel he was bound by the same rules as others. Kind of again, like a friend of your tongue.
Well, there's two sets of rules, Timmy. One, I'm a 1%er, Timmy.
Yeah, you are.
No, you are not.
He's 1%, all right.
Yeah, well,
not too many colonel people go around and call himself the colonel. So he's a rare breed,
Colonel Hawk.
At school, young Ian was a bright student, and he was handsome and a well-dressed boy, but he was not very well-liked. At the age of 11, he passed his entrance exams to get into Shawlands Academy, which I guess was a pretty good school, but he never realized his potential. He was lazy and would not apply himself, and he was misbehaved.
Again, sounds like the devil.
Yeah, it's pretty much a bio of her so far.
Yeah, I know.
He started smoking and virtually gave up on schoolwork. Now, he developed a fascination with Nazi Germany, Nazi pageantry, and Nazi symbolism. He often asked other boys for souvenirs from their fathers who fought in the war. And so he became obsessed with the Second World War, especially with the Nazi side, and whenever they play little war games, he always insisted on being the German. So, sweet guy. It was around this time that he became known for his perverse and sadistic tendencies, including bullying smaller children and torturing animals in a variety of grotesque ways.
Did you say bullying or boiling?
Boiling.
Bullying?
Look, I'm barely going to get through this podcast, so if you give me a break, I'd appreciate it.
Well, no, I honestly didn't know what you said. Bullying. Yes. Okay, thank you.
By the time he was younger, he had brought before the juvenile courts for incidents of robbery and housebreaking. So he got in trouble early on. On his first two occasions, he was given probation, but on the third, he was deemed incorrigible, and the court ordered him to leave Glasgow and go live with his mother. She had since moved to Manchester and married an Irish laborer named Patrick Brady. In November of 1954, 2 months before his 17th birthday, Ian left the Sloan household and traveled down to join his mother and her new husband. Now, he didn't get along with his stepfather, but he took his stepfather's last name of Brady and used it as his own. So he was a young Scot exiled in an English city. So that compounded his feelings of isolation and hostility. So his hostility began to manifest itself in other ways. He would spend hours in his room reading and listening to music. He developed, and it sounds like every other teenager I've ever known, He developed an interest in writing of the Marquis de Sade. Of course, Brandy is very familiar with his writings. And Friedrich Nietzsche.
Of course.
He became increasingly enamored with the philosophy, with a philosophy that championed cruelty and torture, and the idea that the superior creatures had the right to control and destroy, if necessary, weaker ones. Now, I know you
It's Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you supply to that.
I'm an adherent to that philosophy, Timmy. That, you know, the weak perish and the strong shall survive.
Darwin.
Hmm? Well, Brady avidly collected books about torture and sadomasochism. Thank you.
There we go.
And other paraphernalia relating to domination and servitude.
Again, the devil.
Yeah, it's a Saturday night. About this time, he worked at a butcher's assistant. So we got all these serial killers who worked as butchers at one time or another. I think he just rounded up all the butchers and, like,
just
question them.
Just randomly lock up half of them.
Yeah,
he probably stopped a lot of crimes.
He probably would. And some people have commented that it was his experience as a butcher that kind of led to his fascination with mutilation. Yeah.
Excellent.
He also began to start to drink heavily as a teen and frequently go to the cinema. And he often found that he needed a little extra cash for that, so he took on some new habits. He also gambled on horse races. So in order to support his gambling and his drinking habit and his cinema habit, I guess, the young man resorted to thieving. Yes. He had been convicted several more times for stealing and robbing, and he was arrested for an incidence of public drunkenness, which, you know,
he's like 14.
Sounds like Brittany, doesn't it?
It's a lot like Brittany, yeah.
We miss you, Brittany, wherever you're at. He was sentenced to 2 years at a reform school. And then later he had spent a bit of time at Strange Ways Prison. I'm not sure about you, but I don't want to spend any time at Strange Ways Prison.
That doesn't sound
appealing at all.
Well, I don't know, though, because I do not want to spend any time at the Normal Ways Prison.
Yeah, either one, but Strange Ways does not sound appealing at all to me. While incarcerated, Brady learned illegal techniques for acquiring money, and entertained grandiose fantasies of becoming a big-time criminal, pulling off lucrative bank heists. He hoped to avoid manual labor. Well, don't we all?
Yeah,
Colonel, you've successfully done that.
I have done that my entire life, Timmy.
Yeah. And aimed to appear respectable. So he studied bookkeeping. He went through, you know, long stretches of unemployment. He worked as a laborer in a brewery in 1958. After that, he was unemployed for several months. He eventually found a job as a stock clerk in a place called Millward's Merchandising. And this would be important because about 2 years later at that job in January 1961 is when he would meet Myra Henley, who had been hired at Millward's as a shorthand typist, and we'll talk a little bit about her in a minute. So that's where they kind of, you know, they met. For 12 months after he met Myra, though, he was really not interested in her. He was a little aloof, but she had the hots for him.
Playing hard to get.
He was, but she had the hots for him.
Tramp.
So at a Christmas party, office Christmas party, after relaxing to a few drinks, he finally asked Henley out for a date. So, and there's office Christmas parties.
I know.
So let me talk a little bit about Myra, and then we'll get into their Brandy will get into their dastardly deeds. Myra Henley was born on July 23rd, 1942. She was born on July 23rd, Colonel.
Her mama was pregnant during the holiday. No, they conceived during the holiday. They had a good old time during the holidays.
Yeah, they were probably banging at Thanksgiving or so. Maybe first of
July?
Yeah, well, yeah.
7 months, take them back. I don't know, devil. Was they doing that holiday?
I don't know. It's too much for me to figure out.
Halloween. Right, she's a Halloween baby.
Yeah. So anyway, she was born to a working class family in Manchester, England. She was the daughter of Nellie and Bob Henley. Her mother and her father, her mother and her alcoholic father beat her regularly as a young child.
There you go.
She probably had to come.
No, it was regularly. Like, they had it scheduled, I think.
Yeah. Every Thursday, every Saturday.
Every Tuesday, Thursday, 10 to 2. The small house the family lived in was in such poor condition that Myra and her parents had to sleep in the only bedroom. So that had to put a cramp in your style. She slept in a single bed next to her parents' double bed.
Oh, she probably saw some ugly, ugly deeds
there.
Yeah,
it's probably... Mm-hmm. Probably was not a pretty... the family rooms, family living conditions deteriorated further when Myra's sister Maureen was born in 1946. Shortly after after the birth, Myra, then age 5, was sent by her parents to live with her grandmother who lived nearby. A lot of people made a lot of... I've read some stuff where they made a big point about this, like this was a turning point when she was sent away. But I saw a documentary where her grandmother lived, like, right across the street. So it wasn't like she was, you know, being sent off to, you know...
Right.
You know,
Siberia.
Or someplace. Myra's father had fought in North Africa, in Cyprus, and Italy during the Second World War. He had served with a parachute regiment. I'm not sure why that's relevant. But he was known as a hard man and expected his daughter to be equally as tough. He taught her how to fight and insisted that she stick up for herself. When Myra was 8 years old, a local boy approached her on the street and scratched her on her cheeks with his fingernails, drawing blood. But she started crying. She ran to her parents' house, and her father saw that. He demanded that she go punch the boy because he told her if she didn't go hit the boy, he was going to lather her, which I guess means to beat the
shit. He's going to light her ass.
Yeah.
So she found the boy and succeeded in knocking him down with a sequence of punches and kicking him in the scrotum.
Ah! But now see why we got to bring this into it.
I'm just saying. And her father, you know, he was proud of her. And at 8 years old, Myra had her first victory. Air quotes there.
There you go.
Quick question, Deb. Mm-hmm. Not to get down a rabbit hole, but, you know, and I hear about these people. You ever teach your kids how to fight?
Ever teach my children how to fight?
Yeah.
I've taught my children how to defend themselves.
I have not taught my kids. I had 3 boys. I have never taught them how to fight. I guess they just like a little wolf pack. They learned it on their own, but...
Probably with each other.
Never.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what I mean, fighting with each other. But I never taught them how. I guess I gave them some tips, but...
Clara has, you know, she has a little boy, and she's concerned about that. Because, you know, Columbia can be pretty rough. So she's got him in karate classes.
You know, yeah, I mean, my kids went through the Israeli self-defense classes, but I never taught them how to fight.
Okay, so so she didn't have the best of childhood. She was beaten by her father a lot. He was a pretty rough guy. When she was 13, one of her closest friends, who lived on a nearby street, had invited her to go swimming at a local swimming hole on a reservoir. She chose not to go. She was a good swimmer, but she chose not to go with him and went with another friend instead, and this little boy ended up drowning, and she always blamed herself for that
death. Well, it was her fault, really.
Well, yeah.
Her friend's death really devastated her. She took up a collection for a funeral wreath, but she never really did get over his death. After attending his funeral, Michael's funeral, she was increasingly drawn to the Catholic Church. And she began taking instructions for formal reception into the church soon after his funeral. She took the confirmation name of Veronica and received her first communion in November of 1958. Let's see what else was going on. She started bleaching her hair at this time, which will become a big thing later on. Her first job was as a junior clerk at a local electric engineering firm. She ran errands, made tea, and typed. She was well-liked, and so she kind of got along with everyone. She had a short relationship with a guy named Ronnie Sinclair, and they got engaged briefly, but they called it off later on because she said he was too immature. I get the sense that she kind of liked bad boys. Shortly after her 17th birthday, she changed her hair color again with a pink rinse. Who's that remind you of, Colonel?
The devil.
Yeah.
Pink-haired devil.
Yeah. So anyway, she took a job in an engineering company, but she was fired shortly thereafter for absenteeism. In 1961, 18-year-old Myra joined Millward's as a typist. She soon became infatuated with young Ian Brady, despite learning that he had a criminal record. Again, she kind of liked the bad boys. She's
liking the bad boys.
She began a diary, and although she dated other guys, most of her entries in her diary detailed her fascination with Brady, who she eventually spoke to for the first time in July of 1967. Remember, it was in December when he finally asked her out on a date, so he wasn't so hot on her. But when he did ask her out, they went to the movie, and they saw a film about the Nuremberg trials. So, he's obsessed with the whole Nazi thing. So they started dating, which generally meant a trip to the cinema to usually watch X-rated films, and then back to Myra's house to drink German wine and have sex.
And I bet it was
sexy time.
That sadomasochistic sex.
Probably. Brady then gave her reading material. Brady gave her reading material, and the pair spent their work lunch breaks reading to each other aloud about the Nazis' atrocities. So it sounds like a very romantic thing.
Oh, so they're like skinheads.
Yeah, kind of. Although she, to emulate the idea of Aryan perfection, she bleached her hair blonde.
Sure.
And applied thick crimson lipstick.
Did she get the curtains match your drapes there, or do we know what she did down there?
I don't think they did, no.
Oh,
okay. She expressed concern at some aspects of Brady's character in a letter to a childhood friend. She mentioned an incident where she had been drugged by Brady, but also wrote her obsession with him. A few months later, she asked her friend to destroy the letter. Within months, Brady had convinced her that there was no God at all. So she went from being a Catholic to being an atheist.
Such it took healthy. Brady months. Because I've seen the devil convince people there's no God at all in like 20 minutes.
It's like such a healthy relationship that she's in. She should be proud.
Myra began to change her appearance further, wearing clothing considered risque, such as high boots, short skirts, leather jackets. And the two became less sociable to their colleagues, so they just started spending more and more time
leather
together.
Leather jacket's a sure sign of a heathen.
It is.
The couple were regulars at the library, borrowing books and philosophy, as well as crime and torture. Although she was not a qualified driver, Myra often rented a van in which they planned robberies. That was their big thing they was going to pull off. First, before they got into killing, they were going to be bank robbers.
It's good to have goals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they started taking up spending time at the rifle club, and Myra and Ian started practicing their shooting skills, and they bought a .22 rifle. She also joined the pistol club. She was a poor shot. And also had a bad temper, which is a bad combination, really.
It is a bad combination. And really, I'm going to say this, and I don't want to offend our listeners.
Please don't.
Because I know a lot of you are female. But females and guns don't mix, Timmy.
Did you know Dr. Ruth was a trained sniper?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
She was the best shot. Like, she was a trained sniper. She was the best shot in the Jewish army.
Well, I go down to the target range, and I will see women down there, and I will see them.
Israeli army? No, I mean, is that where she was?
Israeli,
yeah. I think so, yeah.
I will see women with guns, shooting the guns, and I will see them hitting targets about 40 yards away, and I will just think, I think to myself, I don't want to be the husband, because they're too accurate with it. They should not have guns.
Okay. Thank you, Colonel.
Yeah.
Brady and Myra's plans for robbery came to nothing. But they then became interested in photography. Can't be a bank robber.
We're gonna snap some pictures of flowers.
Yeah, let's take some pictures of money.
Yeah, do some Snapchatting or something. I don't know. Brady already owned a boxy brownie, a box brownie.
Oh, that's a camera.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the first
mass-produced he cameras. Used to take photographs of Myra with her dog, Puppet. You see these pictures at the Moors, when I tell you the place, the Moors. Mm-hmm.
I believe the French pronounce that poupée.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's this is Puppet. Okay. Her dog is cute, but he has a sad ending. We'll get into that later.
Oh, they kill the dog?
Well, no, they don't. The pair took photographs of each other. At the time, to be explicit, so some like, you know, soft porn, it sounds like. For Myra.
Taking boudoir photos?
Yeah. It demonstrated a marked change from her earlier, more shy nature. So now, what could go wrong? You got these two outcasts dating each other, dreaming, you know, reading about Nazism and
torture
and, you know, shooting guns. So what could go wrong, Brandy?
And they got pistols.
Yeah, they're badass.
Which are guns in most states. Yeah. Jesus. So
you seem a little cranky today,
Myra. Why is it they got guns and you're like, yeah, they have pistols.
Nobody can understand what he says.
I'm sorry. I'm not having one of my better days.
So Myra claimed that Brady began to talk about committing the perfect murder. And he often spoke to her about Meyer Levin's Compulsion, and it was published in 1956. The novel was a fictionalized account of the Leopoldine Loeb case.
Which we did a podcast on.
We did.
Which was not the perfect murder.
And no, but it was a perfect podcast because it was just me and you.
It was just me
and
you.
Which was hurtful because it was my fucking idea, but that's okay. it tells the story of two young men from well-to-do families who attempt to carry out the perfect murder of a 12-year-old boy who escapes, and they escape the death penalty because of their age. So that's exciting and something that we should strive for.
Escaping the death penalty? Ain't none of us going to escape the death penalty for our age.
No. By June...
Yeah, we will, because by the time we go through all of our appeals...
Well, by the time I got my appeals, I'd be 85 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does Thailand have extradition treaty?
We got a free pass. Yes, they do.
Colombia?
Yes.
Oh, so you ain't safe nowhere.
No.
I'm sorry, Devil. Go ahead.
So by June of 1963, Brady had moved in with Myra at her grandmother's house on Bannock Street, and on July 12th of 1963, the two murdered their first victim, 16-year-old Pauline Reed. That evening, Brady told Myra he wanted to commit his perfect murder. So he came to her and said, "It is time.
It is time. I have figured this out."
Yeah, the brain trust has put this all together. So he told her to drive her van around the local area while he followed behind on his motorcycle, because motorcycles are stealthy and nobody ever hears them.
Exactly. Clearly. Nobody ever noticed.
Well, plus he probably looks cooler in a motorcycle.
He'd have been better off on a 10-speed.
Yeah.
But let's see. When he spotted a likely victim, he would flash his headlight. That is very, very covert.
That's not
shit.
Suspicious.
That's not suspicious at all. Very. And then she was supposed to stop in the van and offer this person a ride.
Right.
Because the suspicion has not been raised by the motorcycle.
Well, here's the thing.
With the strobe light on the front.
If you got your little Nazi blonde head dyed hair Nazi
with the high heel leather boots,
the short skirts, offer you a ride, you're hopping in that thing.
You're getting in.
But she's talking about a girl.
I know.
Yeah, so you got a motorcycle.
I would have got in.
I know. But you're talking about a motorcycle with a strobe light on the front, and this is, you know, okay. Right. So, driving down Gordon Lane, Brady saw a young girl walking towards them and signaled Myra to stop, which she did not do until she had passed the girl. How do you mess up? There's one signal. You got one job. One signal.
She doesn't seem like the brightest bulb in the pack there.
Right.
Brady drew up alongside on his motorbike, demanding to know why she'd not stopped and offered the girl a lift, to which Myra replied that she recognized her as Marie Ruck, a near neighbor of her mother.
She
knew the girl.
She knew the girl, yeah.
Shortly after 8 p.m., continuing down Foxmoor Street, Brady spotted another girl.
So the first girl dodges a bullet.
Yes.
Literally.
She's wearing a pale blue coat, white high-heel shoes, walking away from them, and once again he signaled for the van to stop. Myra recognized the girl as Pauline Reed, a friend of her younger sister, Maureen.
I wonder if it occurred to them to go to a different neighborhood.
Right.
They're not that bright.
Why don't you get off your street?
Yeah, I keep knowing all these people. I don't know.
Get off your own street. Go out. You know.
God. It was at Leonard's bar mitzvah, wasn't it?
Yeah. So they saw Pauline Reed, who's a friend of her sister Maureen. Reed got into the van because, you know, clearly she knew the woman. Yeah. You know, they knew each other.
Well, they probably gave up on trying to find a stranger. Yeah.
Well, you probably have to if you're just circling your house.
They were sitting in the driveway.
Yeah. And he's flashing his lights. Yeah. And whatever. That's why they thought it was weird. She's offering him a ride. The van's not moving. Reed got into the van with Myra, who then asked if she would mind helping to search for an expensive glove she'd lost on Saddleworth Moor.
Now, here's my question. How expensive, how much value can a glove have?
You'd be surprised.
When it's cold.
It's clear you've not bought gloves in a while.
I have not bought
gloves. Well, but here's the thing. Back in the 60s, they wore gloves.
As fashion statements.
Yes, a lot of people wore gloves like
that. Well, she dressed like a whore.
No, dipshit. This was Pauline. She didn't dress like a whore.
Marilyn Monroe wore gloves.
No. I mean, Myra asked her to help her, right?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, the girl lost the glove.
Girl. Okay, I'm sorry.
God damn, you wrote this.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Script.
Please go ahead. I thought Myra lost a glove. Go ahead.
No, it looks like the way it is written.
Okay.
That's what it sounds like. Okay. So when the van reached the moor, Myra stopped, and Brady arrived shortly afterwards on his motorcycle. Here he came.
Yeah, Fonzie.
Yes.
He probably was a scooter.
Probably.
He had a moped.
Named it Sasha. It's a Vespa. All right, so she introduced him to Reed as her boyfriend.
He's my boyfriend. He just drives around, follows me everywhere I go.
And said, and said he'd also come to help find the missing glove.
Yeah, you know, you got another set of eyes.
So maybe it was Myra's glove. Who cares?
Brady, whoever's losing the glove.
Somebody
cares.
Lost a friggin' glove.
Well, I want to know where the other one is. Wouldn't she have one of them?
You would think.
Okay.
So Brady took Reed onto the moor while Myra waited in the van.
You know, they solve that problem. Chop off your arm.
It's like that story. I met a man that complained about having no gloves.
Uh huh.
And then I met a man who I chopped off his hands.
Yeah. Just like that.
Oh, I love that parable. Yeah. That's a great story. Yeah. Okay, so Brady took Reed onto the moor.
Okay.
So this girl takes off this guy.
Did these people not see American Werewolf in London?
Clearly not.
Stick to the road. Stay off the moors.
Yeah. So she goes out onto the moor with this guy.
You know, and you got to be careful around the moors.
And Myra waits in the van, you know, in case the glove calls or tries to come
exactly.
back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. After about 30 minutes, Brady returned alone and took Myra to the spot where Reed lay dying with her throat cut.
Ugh.
He told her to stay with Reed while he fetched a spade. He had to fetch a spade. He had hidden nearby on a bridge.
Why is that funny?
Visit to the moor to bury the body.
Why is that funny?
Because you can hear him in the English. I'm about to fetch a spade, mate.
Go ahead.
Rich
Little. Jesus Christ.
Go ahead.
All right. So Myra noticed that Pauline's coat was undone and her clothes were in a disarray.
Oh. They did the dirty.
She had guessed from the time he'd taken that Brady had sexually assaulted her.
That dirty bastard.
Can't have it.
Can't have it.
You know.
But you know what? Had Myra been satisfying his needs...
Oh, obviously.
Yeah.
Returning home from the moor,
she got jealous.
Let's see.
She'd be pissed off.
Stay with me.
All right.
So returning,
hanging on you every word.
Oh. So returning home from the moor in the van, they loaded the motorcycle in the back because now they don't need that loud ass thing.
Well,
that'll attract attention.
Well, and also you save on gas.
Well, yeah. Brady and Myra pass Reed's mother, Joan, accompanied by her son, Paul, searching the streets for Pauline. With their adrenaline pumping from the murder, Ian and Myra went home and made hot, passionate
whoopee. Oh, this was before Viagra, so he was doing good.
They were bumping uglies.
Yeah.
Yuck.
They was knocking boots.
He probably didn't worry about getting her pregnant because he's already shot his main...
I think the secondary load can get you too, though.
Well, maybe it's third. We don't know where he was at that point in the day.
Yeah, he probably knocked one off in the shower beforehand.
Could be. Pauline had a short relationship with David Smith, a local boy with three criminal convictions for minor crimes. Police couldn't find anybody who'd seen Reed before her disappearance. And although the 15-year-old Smith was questioned by police, he was cleared of any involvement in her death.
Yeah, he comes to play later on in his story.
Which is a question I have for you, Timmy. Do you find it, it's off topic, but what I just brought up.
Everything you say is off topic.
Do you find it sometimes, you know, you get up, you get ready for work, and some people meditate, some people do yoga. I have found it empty in the chamber is the best way to clear your mind before you come to work.
I am so grossed out by that right now.
Yeah,
I can't even
I am as well.
Deal with it anymore.
So you're saying...
No, I don't do that.
I'm saying... I'm saying that.
It's not easy because Renee gets up for work at 5:30.
Okay,
the Mrs. Colonel. So I got.
So they got away with it. They
yeah,
got
before
away with
she wakes
with,
up.
Yeah, I got to wake up at 4:30 to do it.
they got away with killing Pauline.
He's having an interesting conversation over here.
I'm done with it. You know what? We just ate, and that makes my belly hurt.
All right.
Sorry, Mrs. Colonel, to give away our personal details.
No, you're not. No, you're not. You're not.
Jesus Christ, we're 50 minutes in this thing already.
Ian and Myra would strike again 6 months later. Their next victim, John Kilbride. You know what? Don't bitch at me. You took forever and a day getting through yours.
Some bitch, you got 10 pages here on me.
All right. So
I'm going to have to do my
the next
speed reader.
Victim, yes, John Kilbride was killed on November 23rd, 1963. Myra approached the 12-year-old boy at a market in Ashton-under-Lynn and asked him to help him carry home some boxes. Brady was sitting in the back of a Ford Anglia car that Myra had rented. When they reached the moor, Brady took the child with him and Myra waited in the car. She does nothing. She waits in the car. She's useless as tits on a boar. Brady.
What do you want her to do? You want her to kill somebody? Jesus Christ.
Should she rape and kill somebody?
If you're gonna, you know, if you're gonna be a part of this little dynamic duo, then yeah, you gotta participate.
Well, keep going, keep going. She contributes.
Jesus God. Tits. Jeez.
If don't bring us war and peace if you're worried about how long it's gonna take.
Let's see. Brady sexually assaulted Kilbride and attempted to slit his throat with a 6-inch serrated blade.
Hold on. He sexually assaulted a guy?
Yeah.
A little boy.
Yeah.
Little boy.
Yeah. He's an equal offender.
He's a sick bastard.
Before fatally strangling him with a piece of string, possibly a shoelace. A huge search was undertaken with over 700 statements taken and 500 missing persons posters printed. 8 days after he failed to return home, 2,000 volunteers scoured waste ground and abandoned buildings searching for the boy. 6 months later, on June 16, 1964, the couple killed again. So 6 months seemed to be their cooling period.
Yeah, and six months.
Their third victim was another 12-year-old boy, Keith Bennett, whom they enticed from a street in Chorlton and drove to Saddleworth Moor. Myra stood and watched from the top of an embankment while Brady sexually assaulted Keith in the ravine before strangling to death with a piece of string and burying his body. That boy's body has never been found. Again, she's just hanging out.
You know, I wonder if she was up there rubbing the devil's button. You know what I mean? The devil's button.
She was considered, I mean, she is really, I was reading it, she, even though he's an evil piece of shit, but she is, you know, in the eyes of folks in that area, seen, you know.
Because she did nothing.
Yeah.
The fourth person murdered by them was a 10-year-old little girl by the name of Leslie Ann Downey. Downey was lured by Myra from a fairground. The couple took their latest victim to Myra's grandmother's house, who was visiting relatives. Brady took 9 obscene photographs with her, showing her naked, bound, and gagged, which were later found in a suitcase in a left luggage locker. Myra recorded the scene of the child's rape and torture by Brady on audio tape. The tape clearly records the voices of Brady, Myra, and the child, who is heard to scream and protest and asks to be allowed to go home and pleads for her life. It is believed she was killed by Brady. The following morning, Brady and Myra drove Leslie's body to Saddleworth Moor, where it was buried in a shallow grave. The attack on their fifth victim, Edward Evans, was witnessed by Myra's 17-year-old brother-in-law, David Smith, the husband of her younger sister, Maureen. The Henley family had not approved Maureen's marriage to Smith, who had several criminal convictions, including actual bodily harm and housebreaking, the first of which, wounding with intent, occurred when he was 11 years old. Throughout the previous year, Brady had been cultivating a friendship with Smith, who had become in awe of the older man.
Yeah, what I've read about that is that, you know, he had Myra as his, you know, his gopher type of thing. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't enough for him, so he wanted to build it.
That was like David Koresh.
Yeah, he wanted to build his little following. And she became very jealous of Smith. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
It was something that increasingly worried Myra. She felt it compromised their safety. Yeah. So, the two of their safety...
She was
not so much worried about anybody else's safety.
She was jealous because he was bringing him into the fold, or trying to anyway.
Shortly before Evan's murder, Brady announced to her that he and Smith intended to roll over a queer.
Roll over a queer.
Which is interesting.
That is a derogatory term, I think.
Well, it's evidently in quotes, but...
This is probably in the 60s, so...
Yeah, and it's interesting because this is coming from a man who has sexually abused two boys.
Yeah.
But we're going to go out and we're going to roll us over a queer.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't...
I'm not gay.
Yeah.
No.
He's only prison gay. He ain't real gay.
No, clearly. Yeah. So, on the evening of October 6, 1965, Myra drove Brady to Manchester Central Station, where she waited outside in the car again.
She's a good chauffeur.
While he selected their victim.
How did he determine they were gay?
Well, you know, because they all have that walk, and they all have, you know.
Okay.
Jeez. Let's see. So Brady went inside and selected their victim, and after a few minutes reappeared in the company of Edward Evans, to whom he introduced Myra as his sister. After they drove back home and relaxed over a bottle of wine, Brady sent Myra to fetch her brother-in-law. A lot of fetching going on.
He does his own fetching, and she does some fetching.
Does some fetching, yes. When they got back to the house, Myra told Smith to wait outside for her signal, a flashing light. So again, when the strobe goes off, be quiet, but come in.
Yeah.
When the signal came, Smith knocked on the door and was met by Brady, who asked if he had come for the miniature wine bottles. How old was this boy? Do we know?
He was older, I think. I want to say 17, but I'll check it out. You go ahead.
Let's see. Okay. A few minutes later, Myra, who'd gone into the kitchen to feed the dogs, heard Brady struggling with Evans and saw Smith standing by the front door. She shouted for him to go and get help, and Smith entered the room to find Brady repeatedly striking Evans with the flat of an axe. He watched as Brady then throttled Evans with the length of an electrical cord. Evans' body was too heavy for Smith to carry to the car on his own. Brady'd sprained his ankle in the struggle, so they wrapped him in plastic sheet and put him in the spare bedroom.
Yeah, he was just kind of killing this guy while Smith walks in and, walks in on it. And
But it sounded like they set him up to walk in.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. They did. So, they did to kind of make him an accomplice.
Well, that's kind of a dick move.
Well, yeah, they weren't the nicest of folks.
So they put him up in the... So they wrapped him up.
Already killed 7 people.
So they wrapped him up and put him in the spare bedroom.
Yeah, Edward Evans was 17 years old.
Okay. Smith agreed to meet Brady the following evening to dispose of Evans' body, but after returning home, he woke his wife and told him what he'd seen. Maureen told him that he must call the police.
Good advice.
There, somebody in that family finally.
Yeah.
Finally picked up the damn phone.
3 hours Hello, later, Sarah. The couple cautiously made their way to a public phone box in the street below their flat. Smith, taking the precaution of arming himself with a screwdriver and a kitchen knife to defend them in the event that Brady suddenly appeared and confronted them. At 6:07 a.m., Smith made an emergency services call to the police station in nearby Hyde and told his story to the officer on duty.
And that led to, early in the morning of October 7th, 1965, shortly after Smith's call, Superintendent Bob Talbot of the Cheshire Police arrived at the back door of 16... Timmy, now you're trying to distract me, and I'm trying to...
Not doing anything.
...of 16 Waterbrook Avenue, wearing a borrowed baker's overall to cover his uniform. He was going undercover.
He's undercover.
Oh, nice.
He's undercover boss.
He's a slick dick.
But as soon as Myra opened the door, he identified himself as a police officer and said, "Let me talk to your dirty bastard boyfriend."
And she said, "I thought you were a baker."
Yeah, she said, "I thought you had some bread. Where's my bread?" So Myra took him to the living room where Brady was sitting up in a divan, writing a note to his employer. Yeah?
I'm confused. Okay.
I think it's like an English cat love seat.
Okay.
He was writing a note to his employer explaining that he would not be able to get into work because of his ankle injury. Now, Talbot said that he was investigating an act of violence involving guns that was reported to have taken place the previous evening.
Guns?
Guns, Myra says. "I do not know anything about that," and allowed the police to look around the house.
She got the vapors.
Myra claimed that the key, they went upstairs, in which Evans' body was stored, and the police found the door locked and asked for the key. And Myra said the key was at work, but after the police officer said, "I'll drive you to work to get the key," Brady told her to just hand it over. They knew the gig was up.
The gig was up.
So when they returned to the living room, the police told Brady that they had discovered a trussed-up body and that he was being arrested on suspicion of murder.
But not her.
Not her.
Well, of course not her, because all she does is drive the car and stand around and feed the dogs.
Yeah. Well, remember, the guy told her that he went in and saw Brady beating this guy, so...
Now, as Brady was getting dressed, he said, Eddie and I had a row, and the situation just got out of hand.
They had a row.
We had a row.
You gotta be careful when you have a row. Anything can happen.
I like rows of Oreos.
Yeah. Myra was not good. Arrested with Brady, but she demanded to go with him to the police station, accompanied by her dog, Poupée.
Oh, we got to take the dog.
Puppet. I would be heading the opposite direction.
Never trust puppets.
I'll meet you down there.
You never trust puppets. Puppets lie.
They get off when you put their hand up there. Yin-yang.
Puppets are untrue. No matter what a puppet says, they don't care about you.
Nah. It's all just parroting what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Am I... To continue, or...
Please, unless you want to talk about Charlie McCarthy, please do.
Myra was questioned
And Charlie McCarthy really didn't need that monocle, because he was a puppet.
Maybe he had a hard time seeing. He was disabled. Maybe he's appealing to that crowd.
Yeah. Go ahead, Colonel.
Okay, so on the early morning of October 7th...
My mom had a Charlie McCarthy thing that she made, and we broke it with a football, and so now... All she has left is this ceramic head, jagged neck, jacked up.
I think puppets
Charlie McCarthy.
Puppets are creepy.
Puppets are creepy. Lamb Chop was creepy.
Like Twilight Zone, where the puppet came to life.
Lamb Chop was creepy, dude.
Yeah, Lamb Chop was.
And you know what else is creepy? If you use Lamb Chop as a pot holder, and she got a little bit singed, and then you made her run around screaming that she got burned.
You know what I don't like is when, like, the puppet master, you can see them, their voice, you can see their lips moving.
I hate that.
I know. Like Madam, remember Madam?
I do remember Madam.
Yeah.
I knew somebody that looked just like Madam. You looked like Madam a couple of times when you get new glasses, hadn't he?
The colonel know what you're doing here. I'm not going to...
No, but seriously, doesn't he look like Madam sometimes when he has his new glasses?
Yep.
Continue, Colonel.
But the colonel not going to lose his cool because the colonel read the script and he can summarize it real quick.
No. Go through the story.
They got arrested. They got convicted. They went to trial. They was guilty. They found all but one of the bodies. The end.
No, no. Come on. Come on.
Okay, hold on. I forgot
what happened to the dog.
Yeah.
Poupée?
Yeah.
Come on.
Well, Poupée, well, okay. Myra was questioned about the events surrounding Evan's death, but she refused to make any statement beyond claiming it was an accident.
My bad.
Now, the police had no evidence that Myra was involved in this murder, so she was allowed to go home on condition that she returned for the next day for further questioning. Now, Myra was at liberty for 4 days following Brady's arrest, during which time she went to her employer's premises and asked to be dismissed so that she would be eligible for unemployment benefits. Her employer told her politely to go bang herself.
It's not true.
So she did not get her unemployment benefits. While she was in the office where Brady worked, she found some papers belonging to him in an envelope that she claimed that she did not open, which she burned in an ashtray. Mm-hmm. She believed they were the master plans for the bank robberies and not to do with the murders.
Love master plans.
But on October 11th, 4 days later, she was charged as a what?
Accomplice.
Accessory.
Murderer.
I thought I asked a woman because I thought you know about accessories, but. Anyway, now Brady admitted under police questioning that he and Evans had fought, but insisted that he and Smith had murdered Evans between them. Now, Myra Henley, he said, had only done what she had been told, like a good woman. Smith told police that Brady and Myra had hidden evidence in two suitcases stored in a left luggage office. That's like where you leave luggage, not on the left-hand side.
What about the right luggage office?
Or left?
This is the liberal luggage office.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere in Manchester.
Oh, the gay luggage.
Now, the police were asked to search all the stations looking for this, and they later found the ticket in the back of Myra's prayer book. Inside one of the cases were 9 pornographic photographs taken of a young girl naked with a scarf tied around her mouth and a 13-minute tape recording of her screaming and pleading for help. There should have been no reason for a trial after that. They should have automatically instituted criminal justice.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, it's the audio. It's online. It's pretty chilling.
I have not heard it.
Nope, not going to.
The mother, Leslie Ann Downey's mother, later listened to the tape and confirmed that it was her daughter's voice. That had to be a hellish thing to listen to.
Yeah.
Police searched the house and found an old exercise book in which a named John Kilbride had been scribbled, which made them suspicious that Brady and Henley may have been involved in unsolved disappearances of other youngsters. Now, the police found all kinds of photographs in the house. Many seemed to have been taken on Saddleworth Moor. 150 officers went to search the moor looking for locations that matched the photographs. And a couple days later, they found an arm bone sticking out of the moss. Officers presumed that they found the body of John Kilbride, but soon discovered that that was Leslie Ann Downey. Ann Downey had been in the moor watching the mother as the police conducted the search, but she was not present when the body was found. She was shown the clothing recovered from the grave and identified that as her daughter.
Yeah.
Police were able to locate another site 5 days later where they found a badly decomposed body of John Kilbride, whom they identified by his clothing. The same day, already being held for the murder of Evans, Brady and Myra appeared at Hyde Magistrate's Court with Leslie Ann Downey's murder. Each was brought before the court separately and were remanded into custody. They continued searching for the bodies, but it was called off in November. So now they're going to have a trial. And many of the photographs taken by Brady here featured Myra's dog, Poupée.
Puppet. So,
sometimes as a poupée, and sometimes... Now, the detectives arranged for the animal to be examined by a veterinary surgeon, determine its age, from which they could date the pictures to be taken. Now, that's some smart-ass forensic stuff right there.
Mm-hmm.
The examination involved an analysis of the dog's teeth, which required a general anesthetic from which Puppet did not recover. Puppet took one for the team, as he suffered from an undiagnosed kidney complaint. Puppet.
Puppet.
Now,
that word.
Now, Myra Myra, she just became furious. She was beside herself and said, "You murdered Poupée. You murdered Poupée."
Yeah.
That was one of the few occasions I got any emotional response.
Here's a photo of her and Poupée.
She's not bad looking.
Yes, she is.
Is she?
She's horribly scary.
Oh. Not from that angle. But her face is hidden. Now, the trial was held over 14 days in April. There was huge public interest in this. They were each charged, holy shit, she the ugliest woman. She scared me to death. Timmy showed me a picture. She is one homely-ass woman. And I seen some ugly women in my day. That's an ugly woman right there. So, now, the pair were each charged with three murders, those of Evans, Downey, and Kilbride. It was considered that there was sufficient evidence to implicate Myra in Kilbride's death. The chief prosecution witness, David Smith, during the trial, it was revealed that he had entered into an agreement with the newspaper that he initially refused the name, even under intense questioning, guaranteeing him £1,000.
Yeah, that's fucked up, man. Your key witness decides to make a deal with, not with the prosecutor, but with the newspaper.
Yeah, equivalent to £10,000 today, and I don't know how many dollars that is.
It's about $20,000.
$20,000 today. So for the syndication rights to the story, if they were convicted. Something the trial judge said was a gross interference with a course of justice. Now, Smith finally admitted that he had done it, and they were paying him $20 a week as well as accommodating him in a 5-star hotel for the duration of the trial. Of course, they pleaded not guilty. Brady said, you know, yeah, I hit him with an axe, but I didn't kill him, arguing.
Yeah, I hit him with an axe.
Yeah, I hit him with an axe.
It's done out of love.
But the axe didn't kill him. It was actually strangulation that killed him. Under cross-examination by the prosecution counsel, all Brady would admit was that I hit Evans with the axe. If he died from axe blows, I killed him.
Right.
But I mean, the coroner was saying he died from strangulation.
And I know nothing about that.
Yeah, I don't know anything about strangling nobody. Yes. So anybody, the tape of Leslie Ann Downey, the poor little girl, on which voices of Brady and Myra were clearly audible, was played in open court. Myra admitted that her attitude towards the child was brusque and cruel, but claimed it was only because she was afraid that someone might hear Downey screaming. Myra claimed that when Downey was being undressed, she herself was downstairs when the pornographic photos were being taken, and she was looking out the window, and that when the child was being strangled, she was running a bath. You know, she lit some candles right there. Somebody being strangled in the next room.
Yeah, she couldn't help it. By the way, 10,000 British pounds is 14,571 U.S. dollars.
Man, the pounds dropped, ain't it?
Yeah, that was the reduction. Exchange rate. Yeah, they used to be $2.
Well, it took them 2 hours to find him guilty on all counts. Brady was sentenced to 3 concurrent life sentences because they had done away with the death penalty then.
Yeah, well, you know what? They need to bring that back.
They need to bring criminal justice on them. And this one would be... I'd have to borrow a page from Vlad the Impaler on this one. Mm-hmm. You know, Vlad used to take his victims and...
I understand.
Yeah, because he believed that you had to terrify people. Mm-hmm. You know, killing somebody was easy, but watching some... You know, if you knew you were going to suffer for days... And the strange thing about impaling, Timmy... Mm-hmm. Is that it took literally days for you to die because they would not make these sticks that sharp. Mm-hmm. So your weight would just slowly, slowly lower onto them, and they'd be big and round. Jeez. And they'd insert them into your rectum.
What if you had to pee? What if you had to pee?
I don't know. I don't think you got a timeout from the things. And but anyway, that's what the colonel would do to these people.
Yeah, they're pretty disgusting.
And then I'd let people throw pebbles at them. Not big rocks, because you could kill them easy. Right. But anyway, they got 3 life sentences. Brady was taken to prison and to Durham, and Myra was sent to Holloway. Now, in 1985, Brady allegedly confessed to Fred Harrison, a journalist working for the Sunday People, that he had also been responsible for the murders of Pauline Reed and Keith Bennett, something that the police already suspected, as both children lived in the same area and disappeared at about the same time.
You know, the weird thing is that, unlike in the United States, if you got
inmates in the United States, they're not allowed to communicate to other inmates, correspond.
Yeah.
They correspond for quite a long time, Myra and Ian, through mail.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. And U.S., they don't allow them to do that, but they allow them to do that there.
Well, the newspaper reports prompted the Greater Manchester Police to reopen the case. Now, this Topping visited Brady, then being held at Gartree Prison, but found him scornful of any suggestion that he confessed to more murders. Now, police decided to resume their investigation of Saddlemore Moor, once more using the photographs taken by Brady and Meyer to help them identify possible burial sites. Meanwhile, in November 1986, Winnie Johnson, Keith Bennett's mother, wrote a letter to Myra begging to know what had happened to her son, a letter that Myra seemed to be genuinely moved by. It ended, "I'm a simple woman. I work in the kitchen of Christie's Hospital. It has taken me 5 weeks' labor to write this letter because it is so important to me that it is understood by you for what it is. A plea for help. Please, Miss Henley, help me." Now, police visited Myra, then being held in prison a few days after she received the letter. I keep thinking I'm going to sneeze here. Excuse me. There were threats made against her. Should she visit the Moors? But Home Secretary Douglas Hurd agreed with Topping. They took her back out to the Moors, really, to see if she could show the body, find out where the bodies were. She made two visits out there. Myra walked around, but it was difficult for Myra to make a connection with the area. She didn't really remember it.
Yeah, it was like 20 years later.
So she was returned to the helicopter and was taken back to a cell. What they should have done
most of the time in the car
was tossed out of the helicopter, but they didn't do that.
Yeah.
Now, this Detective Topping was criticized by the press, who said it was a fiasco, publicity stunt, a mindless waste of money. But he continued to visit Myra in prison, and they kept going on. Now, she made a formal confession to this murder 21 years after her previous convictions. 21 years. Now, police visited Brady in prison and told him Myra's confession, and he said, "Nah, I don't believe that stuff." Now, once presented with the details that Myra provided of Pauline Reed's abduction, Brady decided that he was prepared to confess to, but on one condition: that immediately afterwards he be given the means to commit suicide.
Okay.
I've been okay with that.
They could have just given him a rusty can. A spoon.
A spoon.
Spork, yeah. So anyway, now he had a better idea where the body was. And on the afternoon, he gave him directions to the body. They found it 100 yards from the place where Leslie Ann Downey had been found. Brady had been cooperating with the police for some time. When news reached him that Reed's body had been discovered, he made the formal confession. Now, on August 25th, police called off the search of Saddleworth Moor. They never did find Keith Bennett's body. Now, following his conviction, Brady was moved to Durham Prison, where he asked to live in solitary confinement. He spent 19 years in mainstream prisons before he was declared criminally insane.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Much like Timmy was about 5 years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he's like 76 years old now, I think.
Yeah, in November 1985, he was sent to high-security Ashworth Psychiatric Hospital. He has since made it clear that he never wants to be released. The trial judge had
recommended
Right. That life should mean life, and successive home secretaries have agreed with that decision. The death in November 2007 of John Streffin, who had spent 55 years in prison for a triple child murder, meant that Brady became the longest serving prisoner in England and Wales. As of 2011, he remains incarcerated and incapacitated.
Yeah, he's still incarcerated today.
Yeah.
I read an article from the Daily Mirror, I think, or Daily Mail, I think, in the UK. That the state has spent something like $14 million on this guy.
Why didn't they give him something to kill himself?
I don't know.
They don't have the death penalty there, but you know.
But they did remain, him and Myra remained in sporadic contact for some time. But Myra fell in love with one of her prison officers, Patricia Cairn.
She changed teams.
She went to Team Patricia.
What choice did she have?
Yeah. Well, they had to have men officers there, too.
I don't know. In Britain, I don't know.
They got bobbies.
Yeah, so, but not prison officers.
Well, Myra died from bronchial pneumonia caused by heart disease at the age of 60. Cameras crowded the pavement outside, but none of Myra's relatives were among the congregation of six who attended a short service at Cambridge Crematorium as they were living anonymously in Manchester under assumed names.
Hell yeah. That's pretty bad when your whole family has to change your name.
Well, after 35 years after the murders, a reported 20 local undertakers refused to handle her cremation.
That's good. So the undertakers were saying, no thanks.
I would have thought to catch an on fire would be kind of fun, but
they
anyway.
They should have taken him to the Avery Salvage
Yard. They should have
Avery Salvage Yard, throw her in a burn barrel, be done with it.
Take her to the Moors.
You know who could have taken care of this? If you need and also I meant to mention this in my sponsor. If you need a body buried, call a dirty hoe.
Dirty hoe.
They'll dig a hole for you. So anyway, 4 months later, Myra's ashes were scattered by a former lover, a woman she had met in prison. She went all rug cleaning in there, carpet munching and everything else. God, woman got heathenly. Ooh-wee.
She was the licking lips.
Ooh-wee.
Knocking high heels.
You know what? Finish. Just finish.
But her former lover, a woman she had met in prison and had done devious sexual acts with one occasion, scattered her ashes 10 miles from Saddleworth Moor. And then her former lover went back home to her girlfriend where they engaged in more deviant acts of sex. Yeah.
Stop talking. It got her very excited,
and she went and...
I didn't mention, Ian is 78 years old. His birthday was on January 2nd, 1938. January 2nd, Carl.
January 2nd?
His mother was pregnant during
his mother was big old booming belly during the holidays.
Okay, so Ian Brady is still alive. You'd be glad to know he's still alive, and he's 78 years old and still in prison. And
I can write him. Maybe he can be my prison husband.
He can be your pen pal, perhaps.
Yeah.
I wonder if they just come in and toss him over a counter every once in a while and just use him like.
I don't know. I saw where he was complaining about the treatment he was getting and the health care was poor. He wants to commit suicide. You know.
Felicia.
Yeah. Bye, Felicia. But I did see that they spent something like $14 million on his care since 1966 when he was arrested or when he was convicted. So, Brandy, what's your final thoughts on Ian Brady and Myra Henley, the Moor murderers?
They're horrible people.
They're probably, I say this every time, but these are probably the most disgusting ones we've had. I mean, they did it. They murdered people for no. I mean, kids, just kids for no.
Well, we've had a lot of disgusting ones.
Well, Albert Fish, but there's something particularly gross about, a tag team or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the couple murders.
Yeah, there's something. You got crazy Kathy. You cut up her husband. Well,
you got the penis cutters.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody like a penis cutter.
No. But I think the ones with kids make it especially gross.
Yeah.
Colonel, your final thoughts on Ian Brady and Myra
Henley? Well, I got two thoughts, Timmy.
Do you?
And we'd really like to hear the listeners on this. If you want to text your thoughts to Timmy.
Oh, okay. No, not text your thoughts to me. Here's what we're going to do. We keep getting asked for pictures of the colonel, and everyone wants a picture of the colonel. Really, they want to see if you're white or black. That's the big thing. So what we're going to do is this. I'm going to take a picture of the colonel right now as we speak. If you want a picture of the colonel, you can text me.
Do I need any mic over?
You can text me at area code.
Nope, just at Facebook.
I'll give out my number. I don't care.
What's wrong with you?
You can text me on my... Well, I can always change it.
Well, just have him Facebook.
I'm taking this picture right now.
Have him send you a thing on Facebook. A request on Facebook.
You can text me at area code 513-212-7745. That's 513-212-7745.
You can also drunk dial that number, and I would encourage you to do that.
No, do not. I don't talk
on the phone. I would love that.
And text I Love the Colonel to 513-212-7745, and I will send you a picture of the Colonel.
The Colonel in action.
The Colonel in action.
The Colonel during the podcast.
If you prefer not to,
if you want to communicate that way, from this mailing list.
Yeah, if you prefer to do it through email, just send me a message through Facebook, and I'll send it to you that way.
Well, what I think, Timmy, is that the listeners should be encouraged to, on the Facebook page, tell them their version of what the Colonel judge. The kind of Colonel Justice these people get. I think that would be interesting. What I'm saying, they should have been impaled on big, thick poles, so it took a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Covered in honey, had some ants and bees thrown on them.
Mm-hmm.
And
see, it just takes. I understand it's torturous, and I get that. And if that's, I get all that. But you know what? That's just, first of all, that's a waste of good honey.
What about one bullet? One bullet. That's so quick.
I know.
Colostomy.
But then I'm done and I just move
on. Colonoscopy every day without any anesthesia.
Well, that's kind of what the impalement is.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Where can people find us, Brandy?
We can be found on the iTunes.
Yes. Please leave us a review. That's how people find us.
And on Facebook and Stitcher and Twitter, but not YouTube.
Not yet, because
we've run into some regulatory problems.
That's not true.
With the FCC, apparently, with the and I do apologize. I have been working on a political campaign.
Oh my God.
Yes, I've been working on.
I wonder if
Martin O'Malley's political campaign.
Oh, is that why you got 3%?
Okay.
No, so he's got 1%.
So not YouTube, and you can also find us on
Facebook.
I said Facebook.
Okay, check us out on Facebook. Leave your comments there. That seems to be the gathering place.
Get out of here.
It seems to be the gathering place. That's where people leave most of their comments. But if you want to leave a comment on Twitter, we're there as well, at HistoryDweebs1.
Yeah.
And we'll see you all again next time on History Dweebs.
Good day.
Bye, everyone. Bye.